Welcome back to Emerge. Today's guest is Jeremy Johnson. Jeremy is the author of the recent book, Seeing Through the World, Gene Gebser and Integral Consciousness. And Jeremy has quickly become one of my favorite voices in the integral community. He has a delightful way of breaking through the common stuck places that I find the integral milieu tends to find themselves in. And here in this conversation, we explore Gene Gebser, who is a fascinating thinker far ahead of his time, who kind of saw the world that was coming in a truly unique way. And as Jeremy says, perhaps the time for Gene Gebser's perspectives and a perspectives has come back. And so I see this conversation very much to be pulling on, developing the same thread as my previous conversation with John Vervaeke. And just to make this connection clear for listeners, if you've been following the podcast for the previous handful of episodes, I see this pivot to questions of meaning and consciousness to be a natural outflow or further development of the conversations around collapse. I believe, and if you don't see the connection, you can listen to my conversation with Jem Bendel, that this topic of collapse, this possibility or perhaps even inevitability of collapse, is an opportunity for us to reconsider that which we find meaningful, how we derive meaning, and really what the purpose of our lives are, how we want to live this one precious life. And so this conversation, again, like my previous conversation with John Vervaeke, is an exploration of how we might be in the world differently in a way that's appropriate to this time of the Anthropocene. In my conversation next week, I'll be speaking with Catherine McGee, who's the teaching partner of Rob Berbea. Rob Berbea, who I've had on the show previously, I believe, has developed one of the most exciting and innovative approaches to transforming our own relationship with meaningfulness, the sacred, the divine. And in my conversation with Catherine, we're going to look at how that might actually inform, in particular, our relationship to this topic of collapse. And so we're going to be continuing to explore this question of meaning in the face of collapse. And I really appreciate what Jeremy adds to the conversation. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. So without further ado, here's Jeremy Johnson. The Emerge podcast is proud to be sponsored by the Monastic Academy for the Preservation of Life on Earth. The Monastic Academy is a spiritual training center dedicated to amplifying human maturity in the age of the Anthropocene. This July, the Monastic Academy will be offering a circling intensive retreat. This retreat, with weekend and week-long options, is an opportunity to embark on a relational journey, one that weaves together silent meditation and circling, a form of interpersonal and relational meditation. I had the chance to attend the circling retreat that we held here earlier this year, and I can tell you that it is a profound and transformative experience. It's an opportunity to learn ways of relating to others that are deeply nourishing and fulfilling. The skills and perspectives that you'll train in on this retreat will help you bring a quality of presence, connection, and intimacy to all the relationships of your life. Furthermore, my experience is that doing this training, having this retreat in the context of a community of practice, changes the quality of the experience in unexpected and beautiful ways. And so it's different than just going to a drop-in group in your local city. There's something really special, really precious about coming to the Monastic Academy and doing this practice in a community of people who are dedicating their lives to personal and social transformation. And so this is a really great opportunity to check out the Monastic Academy, to train in what I increasingly see as one of the most important skill sets in this planetary transition. And it's also a great opportunity to meet me. I'll be there. I will not be missing this. It's a really awesome opportunity. And so if you're interested in this retreat, I will be putting a link to the Eventbrite page in the show notes, so you can go ahead and check that out. If you have any questions about it, feel free to ask me. But really excited for this event and hope that you can make it. Welcome back to Emerge. On today's episode, I'm joined by Jeremy Johnson. Jeremy is a scholar, writer, and editor for Revelor Press, founder of Neura Learning, and an editor for Mutations, Art, Consciousness, and the Anthropocene. Jeremy is also the current president of the International Jean Gebser Society, and he's joining me today to discuss, in part, his newly available book, Seeing Through the World, Jean Gebser and Integral Consciousness. I've also really enjoyed Jeremy's explorations on his podcast, which goes by the name of Mutations. His episode with Matthew T. Segal is really impressive. And so if you like the conversations I've been having on Emerge, I think you'll really enjoy his podcast and that episode in particular. So check that out. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Daniel. It's wonderful to be here, and thanks for having me on.
Yeah, for sure. And so Jeremy sent me a copy of his new book, Seeing Through the World. And, you know, Gebser is an interesting character. I've seen him mentioned a lot by thinkers that I deeply respect. I've noticed that Bonita Roy, for instance, talks about Gebser a lot. And I've always felt his ideas to be a bit impenetrable. And then when I see them represented, I get the sense that they often lose their vividness or their kind of punch that I imagine that they have in the original text. And so I've always kind of had this weird relationship with Gebser, but I really loved the way that you explored his thinking. It felt really accessible, but also respecting of the depth that is in his work and the kind of as you say, psychoactive nature of how Gebser writes. And what I think I enjoyed most reading your book is that even though these ideas are framed as integral, they kind of deny us the easy answers that contemporary integral theory often seems inclined to offer. You know, it's more of an approach that opens, fertilizes, and evokes new ways of seeing the world. Whereas my experience of integral theory is that it's often used as a way to reduce and box in our understanding along certain defined dimensions or, you know, quadrants, which, as you say in the book, is an expression of the categorical and categorizing mind. And in that way, integral theory actually often feels really stale to me. And it's why I haven't covered it too much on this show. On the other hand, Gebser and your presentation of Gebser feels like a real breath of fresh air, and it has a lot of symmetries to some of the conversations I've been having on the show. And so I thought a good place to start, given I think that a lot of folks who listen are to some degree familiar with integral theory, what do you see as Gebser's relationship to contemporary integral theory, like the sort coming out of and subsequent to the work of somebody like Ken Wilber?
Yeah, that's a great opening question, because for the most part, I think Gebser's work is not really known about outside of the context of integral theory, at least in the English-speaking and English-reading world. So I think a good place to start would be just context, right? So Gebser was, he was born in 1905. He passed away in 1973. And he was kind of a nomad living in different spots throughout Europe during a very turbulent time in which, you know, culture and civilization were kind of bursting at the seams and breaking apart. He was dealing with totalitarian fascist states. He was nearly killed while he was living in Spain, trying to escape the border. He barely escaped into Switzerland, where that became his main living space for the rest of his life when he got a little older. So he really lived through a lot of the challenges and crises that we talk about today in the 20th century in terms of progress, industrialization, identification with, you know, totalitarian concepts of the nation state and these kinds of things. So he was also a poet, and he really began as a lover of poetry. He was kind of a bohemian. He hung out with Lorca and Spanish poets. He spent a lot of time translating Spanish poetry into German. So he is coming from a more, I guess, humanities oriented tradition of literature and poetry and art and in the same sense, philosophy. So he's coming from this more European mixing and mingling of culture, art, and philosophy. And I think with Wilbur and the time period in which his work was translated in, let's say, the 1980s, maybe early 70s, for those who were already kind of familiar with some of the early scholars who were doing the translation work, Wilbur's coming out of the context, I think, in the United States of the tradition of transpersonal psychology, right, and the human potential movement, which was very psychology oriented. So I think that's the context in which he's known. So he's often described as a developmental theorist a brilliant developmentalist. Wilbur often describes him, but he was very much actually against being described as a developmentalist, and the structures of consciousness that he articulated in Ever-Present Origin and in other texts are deliberately non-developmental. He's trying to explore a new way to conceive of the emergence of consciousness. But, you know, I think the way in which he was situated in Ken Wilber's work is a very kind of stage-oriented model of, you know, here's the stage right. One, archaic, magic, mythic, mental, and then it kind of climbs up this ladder of this developmental spectrum. And it's really not the way in which his original work was trying to be situated. So, but that's how I've always seen it. You know, there's just a strong tradition of psychology that was attempting to bring in these spiritual concepts in the 1970s and explore the transpersonal. And I think he kind of slipped right into that, you know, that milieu in America. And I don't think he's really been seen outside of that context too often, except for those who kind of dive into his original writings. So,
And so I wonder if you could unpack why Gebser kind of didn't want to be identified as a developmental theorist, because I too notice that people are quick to lump him into that category of thinker.
So it takes some unpacking of his writing, because essentially his thesis in all of his works, and it sort of began as this poetic flash of insight in the 1930s, a kind of insight into the nature of time and space. He was trying to describe what he calls the phenomenology of awakening consciousness, right? The coming into being of consciousness in a way that wasn't relying upon what he described as perspectival thinking. Mm-hmm. And perspectival thinking is something we're all embedded in and embodying as moderns. It's this kind of spatialized form of consciousness, which didn't always exist in a kind of acute form that it does today, but coalesced and emerged through time. So he didn't want to just sort of fall on some of the assumptions, the kind of structural assumptions that we are thinking through and thinking with today. He was trying to break into a new statement. He described it as a new statement, right? And integral to that statement is this concept that past, present, and future form a more holistic whole, that they are actually interdependent with each other, and that the past is somehow something that is living, it's alive, it has presence, but then so does the future. So he was really trying to see time as a whole and not divide it into stages, you know, where, you know, the past is this level of consciousness and the future is that level. When you create a kind of a stage model, there's an abstraction, and then in that abstraction, you're kind of distancing yourself from it, even if you're describing it and labeling it and categorizing it, and you think you know it, think you map it, but to kind of come into contact with it as a kind of an intensity, that's what Gebser was very interested in. So like the poetry of Lorca, for instance, was somehow, while he was living in Spain, reviving the dead for Gebser. He could feel the presence of the past through Lorca's poetry, and he spoke a lot about this. And then with Rilke's poetry, he has this kind of description of, we'll get into this too, diaphaneity, this sense of the wholeness of a human being that is distributed across time is sort of present in this sort of spiritual present. So, this is sort of where I'm kind of trying to get at that perspectivalism and a stage oriented model is very much in a, it's coming from a deficient mode that Gebser would describe, a deficient mode of consciousness that we're already trying to break out of, you know, it's already failing itself. You know, he lived through all of these crises in the 20th century that were assumed, that were using that deficient perspectival consciousness to try to improve the world, to move towards progress and modernity and the advancement of the nation, and those sorts of concepts were being thrown around. So he was very, very wary of that kind of thinking. And he felt that the 20th century was a sort of culmination of the sort of end state of this structure of consciousness. And so, the challenges in the book is well, how do you write about, you know, the evolution of consciousness or the transformations of consciousness without, you know, falling back on using a convenient model, you know, that we have such a center of gravity there. So I think in some sense, he was sort of ahead of his time, if I can use a linear description, because he didn't want to keep doing that. And I think it's too easy to kind of fall back into it. And I think we've sort of done that today, you know, but
totally. And I mean, I saw, as I was reading your book, so many symmetries with the work of Bonita Roy, who I've had on the show many times, and for, I will continue to have her on the show because I think she has so many amazing ideas and perspectives. And it felt it like, instead of a stage-based developmental framework, which I and a lot of folks I know are very kind of used to, that it was a more process-oriented kind of description of the dynamics that block or break the natural unfolding of, you know, perhaps the aperspectival. It's amazing that he was writing this at that time. Like he being ahead of his time, it's almost an understatement. It's almost like he just kind of, I don't know. It's striking to me how clearly he saw what even now seems to be at the very edge of our collective consciousness. It's beautiful for you now to bring him back, I think, into this context, because it feels like it's a good time to you know, re-encounter him and not try to sublimate him into a developmental framework as Ken Wilber did. I think there's a lot of groundwork that we could do, and probably actually a little bit that we should do, just to kind of have our conversation. One thing that I'd love for you to at least attempt to shed some light on is, so the title of Gebser's, you know, magnum opus is The Ever-Present Origin, and he uses this term origin a lot. And it's not a term that I was familiar with. I tried to get a handle on it, but you know, I don't know that I really do, and I don't know that I'm supposed to. What does origin mean as Gebser uses it? How does he use that term?
So origin is a little bit tricky of a term. In the German, it's Ursprung, which has a kind of an active force to it. You know, there's a sprung in it. So there's this kind of springing forth. And I really like the original German word, at least, because it has a sort of activity of becoming, of creating. And if we could find a synonymous word, perhaps it would be, immanental mind. I don't want to go into theological descriptions, but it could stand in for the Godhead. It could stand in for kind of the divine source or origin of consciousness, of anything that kind of springs forth into being. So it's a sort of spiritual creative originator of any kind of phenomenological sense of being in the world. It's sort of the worlding of the world, as it were. And for Gebser, this wasn't abstract. He had, you know, in the 1930s, this original experience of sensing this sort of time wholeness in which this originating consciousness brought everything into being. And for him, you know, it was a very powerful sense that he had to wrestle with and work through and come to understand for, you know, 20 years or so before he wrote Ever Present Origin. He wrote other books before then as well. So it has a kind of a quasi-theological orientation. So in the mythical, you might say it's God, but in contemplative works, you know, in contemplative traditions, it may be, mind or consciousness or Buddha mind, you know. So it has these kinds of associations, and I don't think they're bad. I think they're helpful, because origin is, I don't know, it's a sort of a neutral term. And here's the thing with Gebser's writing, even in the translation, he's very much trying to very meticulously find new ways to state things. So he didn't want to just use God or source or the divine spark, because, okay, well, that has more of a psychistic, imagistic, mythical quality to it. Well, which is fine, but to find a new way to describe it, which isn't just using that, or to find a new way to use it to describe it, that's not just the Hegelian Geist, which is sort of more of an abstract sense of the spirit. So he was looking for a word that had a lot of that sort of poetic evocation of, divine creative mind. And I think origin or Ursprung really kind of works for that.
I see. Okay, great. Okay. And so another piece of sort of just conceptual groundwork I'd love to put down ahead of the rest of our conversation is this move from the unperspectival to the perspectival to the aperspectival. I really appreciated this way of seeing, when I was reading about your presentation of it, I remember taking an art history class where we studied Renaissance paintings. And we were told that the paintings were significant because it was the first time that art ever attained perspective. And at the time, I remember being totally confounded by this. Like, how could perspective not have always already been present? Which, you know, obviously indicates the kind of mind I had at the time. But, you know, I think the way that you use art and art history to sort of look at the evolution of this movement from unperspectival to aperspectival is really interesting. So can you take us through these different moves of consciousness, these different, I guess you would say, structures of consciousness?
Sure. Okay. Yeah, you're right. I like that description, because that's very often the response that I get when I'm talking to people and introducing the idea. They're like, well, you know, perspective always was, people, they just didn't see it. They missed it. They weren't educated enough. And I find that description, that they weren't educated enough, so telling. You know, it's like, well, we're so based in it now that of course we assume it's the sort of center of gravity of everything. And we just have to kind of, anybody in the past who didn't get it was just uneducated or ignorant, and even that begins to emerge in perspectival art as they're looking back at unperspectival art in the medieval Europe and going, well, they have a deformity of form. They don't know how to create perspective, so there's something wrong with that art. But really, it's just a different expression of time and space. And so, I guess the foundation of these three main expressions for Gebser, they were the terminology that he used before he used the archaic magic mythic mental and integral. He had these three, the unperspectival, the perspectival, and the aperspectival. And he was trying to kind of, with a broad brush, describe what it is like to be phenomenologically present with these particular works of art, whether we're looking at cave paintings or medieval iconography or Renaissance painting. Each one has a different orientation towards time and space. And so Gebter's approach, I think, is very helpful because as you're reading his text, or if you're reading my book, which tries to draw in some of his examples, it's always laying some kind of aesthetic experience for you to encounter and reflect on and kind of go through yourself and kind of go, okay, what am I experiencing when I'm looking at this work of art? Or, you know, the work of art could be architecture itself. So it's kind of the whole McLuhan medium is the message. So how do we embody being in time and space, and how does that embodiment transform over time and become different? So the unperspectival for Gebter is sort of looking all the way back at the sort of Paleolithic cave, right? So the cave paintings and the enclosure of the world. He describes it as a kind of an acoustic space, as the cave very often is, in which the individual is sort of melded into a collective. There's a kind of a we that hasn't centered into the crystallized, you know, modern perspectival ego yet. So the self is dispersed, and the imagination and the sort of the psychic world of dreaming and images and sort of magical potency is sort of diffused amongst the world. You know, the world is almost, we're almost identified with the world in this state. And so he uses the image of, in Ever-Present Origin of Dolmens, which are these interesting architectural Paleolithic structures, basically a pillar and a stone put on top of the pillar, kind of like Stonehenge. But you can kind of take that back to almost a sort of archetypal expression of sort of the stalactite and stalagmite in the cave, right? So there's this kind of cave enclosure, which is a closed world that, you know, in medieval paintings, we can see this as sort of the unperspectival flatness of the painting, right? The angel is flat, and there's not really a sense of dimensionality, which is the beginning of what the unperspectival is. But really, it's kind of the dreaming space. It's the imagistic space. It's the space in which myth and meaning are suffused with the world. Like Richard Tarnas talks a lot about how, you know, the ancient world was more enchanted, and sort of that enchantment shrunk into the individual and sort of kind of got sucked up like a vacuum, right? And there's nothing, you know, that enchantment begins to sort of get drawn away from the outside world and centered in the human ego. And Charles Taylor has a good description of it too, that there's a sort of process that he calls the buffering of the self. But in the unperspectival, that buffering doesn't really exist quite yet. There's a participation in the world, and that world is a psychistic, imagistic world. And you can kind of see how, you know, there's so many factors and variables and dimensions in which we drift out of that and move into agricultural settlements and civilization, which still use myth and everything, but they begin to adapt new forms of time and space because our environment's changing, right? We have agriculture. We're focusing more on the kind of rhythmicity of the seasons. Our gods become more personified. You know, they become more like us, like in ancient Greece, rather than the kind of human animal images that we see in the Paleolithic. We have sort of, you know, god images, or even in ancient Egypt, they have sort of the human becoming animal images of the gods there, or in Mesoamerica, it's the same thing. But we kind of draw away from that more into this person, human-centered consciousness. And really, the perspectival then is not only that, it's sort of the realization in human consciousness of space itself, and space being not the mythical enclosure, but the open plane of the spatial measurable world. And it is as if we've kind of woken up from the dreaming of the mythical and magical structure, which kind of fit with the unperspectival, into this mental awakening of consciousness. So if you would relate it to a state of consciousness, it would be the waking state. It would be the waking, alert, discerning mind moving across a spatial plane. And so you see this sort of possession by the Renaissance artists, right? Of Leonardo da Vinci is the greatest example, but even in sort of the earlier Venetian masters who were beginning to play with perspective in their painting, and they're still painting angels and biblical iconography, but they're adding depth and perspective and layering to the images, and no longer this flat world, no longer the kind of enclosed space, there's a kind of a realism that begins to emerge. And then there's also kind of a moving away from, there's a moving away from looking and depicting faces and people, not as gods, but as everyday people. So there's this move towards the everyday person, you know, the villager, the painting of a villager, painting of a an aristocrat or somebody who could afford it, right? But there's this interest in depiction in humanity. And so the perspectival is sort of man is the measure of all things. It's the fascination with lens crafting. We have like, his name was Sinino Sinini wrote like a treatise on drawing perspective for the first time. And then Battista Alberti wrote Della Pittura for another treatise on perspective. And then we have Da Vinci, and we have this sort of explosion, this eruption of the awakening of space. Gebser has this great line about this structure. I can't recall it offhand, but essentially he's just sort of listing all of the things that are happening all around the same time period, like Copernicus and lens crafting and Galileo, and then the sciences of anatomy are bursting the humors of medieval medicine. So you have this kind of explosion of spatial consciousness, which is very interested in measuring things, which is, you know, we assume and understand today as science, right? The scientific world, the material world. This kind of materialism of space is what kind of erupts in the Renaissance period. And it's not just there. I mean, there's a lot more nuance in Gebser's representation of these things. You can look back to ancient Greece, you can look even further back and see early examples of perspective. For instance, even in Rome, you know, Pompeii and the landscape paintings and the figurines that they're depicting, you know, there's a perspectival realism in that as well. But it really kind of gains momentum for whatever reason, you know, later in the Renaissance. So that takes us to where we are, sort of the cusp of the birth of our, you know, modernity and everything else. But the perspectival world, it's really good at sort of making the cut. And I think phenomenologically, you can orient yourself. If the unperspectival is the cave and the sort of acoustic, imagistic, psychistic space, the mental perspectival space is standing in a plane, sort of looking and observing at the world and sort of phenomenologically feeling like you are sort of an object in space, right? And the Renaissance artists were really good at this. They developed these theories of like the cone of perspectival vision, right? The vanishing point. And so I think phenomenologically we can orient perspectival consciousness as sort of standing on a plane and looking at the vanishing point and measuring space from that vantage point. And he has this beautiful description of the humanist Petrarch, right? Who climbs the famously climbs this mountain with his brother. Nobody climbed mountains and cared too much for painting or depicting landscape in this sort of early Renaissance period. But he goes and does this anyway. And he has this interesting back and forth where he's feeling guilty for climbing this mountain and looking at awe and wonder at the landscape of France. And he writes a letter to his mentor from his college. I think he was a Catholic priest, essentially in the form of a confession, sort of almost apologizing that he became enamored with space and found it wondrous and powerful and awe-inspiring to be up there. And he cracks open a copy of St. Augustine's Confessions, appropriately, on the top of this mountain, and he reads in a synchronistic moment of alignment. He reads a passage about a guy standing on the mountains and looking out to the sea. And so he has this kind of breathtaking moment that Richard Tarnas also talks about that fundamentally made him realize he was in this really important sort of transformation of his own consciousness, this reorientation towards space. But even then, he's sort of thinking and contemplating the St. Augustine phrase that, you know, we only the soul is worthy of contemplation. So he has this guilt about going into this new dimensionality. And as I was mentioning before, you know, perspective, it opens up space, but it also closes things down, because as we were even saying before, perspective becomes this predominant sense of self and world. And mm-hmm. we no longer get to participate in the mythical drama of the gods. You know, the archetypal play of the cosmos begins to sort of wear away and fade into the distance and become a kind of thing that we prescribe to superstition rather than a truly complex and nuanced form of participation. Mm. And so there's a narrowing down and a liberation, because becoming a self in space, the ego is born out of this. You begin to have a sense of self that's no longer in participation with the world, but is more interested in, you know, the eye that measures, and who is the eye and who is the self. And of course we have the eruption of, you know, the printing press and literature and the novel and all that stuff starts to just exponentially kind of explode in terms of all this kind of the development of the perspectival world. But the downside to this is that separation, is that sense, that kind of existential dread of, if all you are is this material self, apart from the world, cut off from the world, you've gained your individuality, but you've lost a sense that, you know, you're part of some spiritual whole. And so there's this sort of gradual diminishment that Gebser describes in the phenomenology of awakening, that we lose a sense of participation with the whole, and we gain a new sense of dimensionality, materialization, and selfhood. Mm. And as we reach the aperspectival cusp, just to kind of sum it up, because this could go on for a while, as we get to the aperspectival, the crisis of the perspectival is this sense of cutting and ratio, the cutting off of the self from the whole, and the assuming that what one sees in the cone of perspectival vision is the whole, is the total, is what is. And it's this sort of false totality, this kind of ersatz wholeness that Gebser prescribes as sort of an issue that he begins to see in the 20th century. We have, or the centuries leading up to the 20th century, fragmentation of nation states and religious movements, the kind of dangerous spatialization of colonialism, kind of going forth and expanding quantitatively these nations across the world, and in the process destroying many other people. And then in the kind of totalitarianism that he was experiencing in the 20th century, perspectivalism was wreaking havoc in terms of creating these sort of homogenized, flat, two-dimensional sense of, like, you know, you are a German or you are a French, you know, this sense of nationality, which flattens out the richness and the complexity and the nuance of the self, ironically undoes the accomplishments of perspective in the first place. So it's kind of like wrought to its uttermost. We reach atomization, ratio, fragmentation, and then, you know, he kind of has this sort of cryptic remark about, you know, the end point may be the complete atomization. He was referring to the atom bomb, you know, of the human being. So he saw this sort of trajectory leading into this crisis of continual fragmentation, continual alienation, and this sort of a kind of a deadening materialism. But this was only the end of the perspectival, right? The aperspectival for Gebser, and I'll make this short because there isn't too much material on it. At any rate, if the perspectival was the realization of the ego and the self in space, then the aperspectival is the discovery of another dimensionality of reality, which is time. Mm. And we assume that we know time as clock time, but for Gebser, time is this, it's almost difficult to describe and put into words. It's this wholeness. It's synonymous with origin. It's synonymous with the manifold dimensionalities of being and consciousness. So for Gebser, it's a sort of new intensified form of consciousness, which is capable of wearing through, or seeing through, as I use in the book, seeing through the world. And so that's where he comes in with the integral terminology. The integral structure of consciousness is this realization of time. But of course, in any of these transformations, there's a big mess. There is, you know, pulling the perspectival and assuming the perspectival can master time. And so we have this kind of push-pull and intensity of history as it sort of speeds up, and technological evolution speeds up, and all of the things that happen in the 20th century. But for Gebser, it's the eruption of time is now this sort of thing that we're coalescing around and being compelled by in the same way that the Viennese masters were working and laboring to realize space in their consciousness. So that is sort of the overview of sort of the first part of Ever Present Origen and his work that he was trying to convey.
Nice. Yeah. And what I really love from this kind of way of presenting it is that I get a sense that perspective itself was this like huge innovation in the structure of consciousness. Like it was a big deal and people had to work really hard in order to kind of discover it or mutate in that direction, if we use Gebser's terms. But that it has now been so thoroughly deployed into the world that we totally take it for granted, like I did in my art history class, and that it is in fact creating the circumstances of its own demise. And in doing that, it is creating a context in which people, like I think the two of us, are seeking for some other way forward. And that seems to point towards the aperspectival, which, is a different way of approaching, I think, a topic that we've talked a lot about on the show, which is this dropping away of any perspective and sort of re-entering the wholeness of life. And I wonder, you know, and I get the sense, you know, from Gebser's work or your presentation of it, that there's like a collective of us sort of frantically exploring this emergent territory in consciousness, trying to cobble together some way of being in the world that actually doesn't emerge as all of the crises that we're faced with. And part of what gives me hope is that just as perspectivalism became something that we now take for granted, that we could create a world in which aperspectivalism is something that's taken for granted. Is that a way that you look at it too, like in terms of our role in this great unfolding of consciousness?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I think that the idea behind Ever Present Origen and Gebser's work and then what we're looking at, it's synonymous in the sense that we all feel that the process of consciousness emergence isn't done with the world that we've accomplished thus far. You know, there's something else that's coming out of this crisis that is new, that is emergent, that is latent or incipient. And the more we can lean into that, the more we can discern the new and the old from each other, the more we can kind of go, okay, we're still reifying the perspectival here. The more we can kind of clear that away and have clarity, the more energy, presence, creativity, just everything that we saw with the emergence of the Renaissance and perspective or any kind of transformation of consciousness can begin to take place now. So I think it's really important, the work that we're doing, in that sense that, it's a clarifying work. It's a kind of a being present in the culture and trying to lean into the latency of the future, you know, what we are becoming. And it's not, I play with this in the first chapter, kind of playfully, but I'm even thinking this might be the next little book, but a kind of an integral futurism, which isn't a mental perspectival futurism, which isn't kind of, okay, we need to progress into a better and better and better future in a sort of a linear way, but to actually go, no, the future, which is latent in us and present in us right now, can inform us and actually informs the present. Mm. And so does the past. And so this kind of wholeness of time that Gebser describes, I think phenomenologically it's a great relief, I think, from the anxiety that we are currently facing. You know, he even begins Ever Present Origen sort of quipping that, you know, only a person who is in this sort of state of transition will bemoan, you know, like the end of the world. And I think we have a good right to have anxiety, but not to the point where it paralyzes us and doesn't allow us to see the new, you know, it doesn't allow us to see the incipient that's emerging today. And so I think, you know, that's why what your work is doing is very important. What Gebser was talking about is a very useful, not only a tool, but a kind of a phenomenological orientation towards this emergent consciousness that if the more we can ground ourselves in that or orient ourselves with it and be present with it, that the answers, the innovations, the creative solutions, those come from that presence. You know, I think that that comes first in this sense. You know,
I love your presentation of Gebser and Gebser in general, because I have this experience when I hear people talk about integral and even like metamodernism, which I've given a lot of airtime to, and you know, there's a lot of similarities integral. Like I find that I get mentally excited about those ideas quite often. But when I hear you speak, like on your podcast or even just now, like my body feels like, I don't know, like vivified or just turned on in a way. It's like you're speaking to a part of me that's just not rational, but is still present in this conversation. And often, I think in conversations with a few exceptions, doesn't get as much recognition as I would like. Perhaps. And I guess what that brings to mind is I know you've listened to a number of conversations that I've had on the show, and you mentioned maybe being curious about exploring how the perspectives that you lay out in the book might, as you say, mingle with something like metamodernism. And I'd be curious for you to share, you know, what are your thoughts in terms of how you might layer or you know, play with metamodernism from a Gebserian perspective.
So I have to admit that I haven't done too much deep studying or reading. I've begun to do that at the moment, but I think my reservation, I guess I could begin with a reservation because I'm still sort of present there, is meta. You know, I talk about this in the book too, meta as this idea of sort of, an abstraction of an abstraction, to me still kind of feels in the perspectival, in the sense of, because the mental is its characteristic trait is thinking about thinking, and is thinking in a sort of abstract terms and maps and you know, the kind of thing that we see in integral theory. And that's, I guess that's my concern, that my kind of stopgap isn't that sort of doing more of the same. And Bonita Roy has an interesting lecture just thinking about the forms of thinking as Gebser described in the Archaic Magic Mythic Mental. And in the mental consciousness, we have what he describes as pyramidal thinking, which is again, that just as we talked about the cone of vision of the line of sight and perspective, mythical consciousness use these polarities, these sort of complementary polarities of night and day, and they kind of move in this sort of rhythmic cyclicality that we can see in a lot of different cultures, of complementary opposites. And the mental isn't as interested in doing that. It can only resolve opposites through a third thing, a triune thing, a sort of a dialectical process, a pyramidal process. And so I, you know, when I hear things about the dialectic or kind of moving and sort of rotating the gyres of modern, postmodern, and then metamodern, it, to me, this all feels like another version of that, but I could be completely wrong, but that is my impression of it. That's sort of my initial impression.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's present in that subculture, and you know, I think partly through explorations with people like Bonita, subsequent to my explorations of metamodernism, I've kind of been a little bit more ambivalent about it for that very reason, like that it seems that what we need is more a kind of ending of that way of framing that tends to categorize things in general and into something that's much more emergent and alive and responsive and organic than what I feel like the metamodernist movement seems to suggest to me.
I guess as a caveat to that as well, it's not that I don't appreciate it at all. And I think to take a position of either or would be just to reify some of the problems of being in the perspectival world of taking an oppositional approach as sort of an object moving in space and opposed to something else, that sort of duality. So I don't want to say no entirely. You know, there's another useful insight that I think Gebser offers us here, and other thinkers have a kind of a similar insight, like William Irwin Thompson. But Gebser describes this as sort of these periods of mutation, these periods of a new form of consciousness trying to coalesce and emerge in us. There's that struggle, and he describes it as Janus faced, right? So the new and the old kind of mingle with each other in interesting ways, like Ken Wilber's integral. I love the idea of we need to think in wholes, and you know, we need to think in integrums. I think that's oriented towards wholeness, but it's still using some of the forms of thinking that aren't up to that task. And so maybe we can kind of be forgiving, and we all do this. We all have this to some degree as moderns, as perspectival individuals. But we are also integral individuals. So, you know, we can lean into something new perhaps as well. But at the same time, there's a lot of Janus faced expressions of these experiments. And in some ways, you know, metamodernism and even integral theory, I think they're good in the sense that they're bringing back some of the healthy forms of the mental, because, you know, the late mental is just oppositional. It's fractioning, it's dividing. It's, you know, the problems that have been slandered at postmodernism as being, okay, endlessly fragmenting into new schools of thought and new identities, et cetera. That fragmentation is sort of, we sort of push back against that a little bit and return to concepts like the dialectic, or return to those things. Those are all healthy mental things. So I don't want to just sort of dismiss them as bad. I just don't think that healthy mental is enough for the integral world we need to realize. You know, I think the answer would be to understand their usefulness and helpfulness, but also understand when we're kind of going back and trying to kind of bring back the older structures to answer a problem that the integral structure is being called for, if that makes sense.
It does. Yeah. And I appreciate that. And like, lest anybody who's listening think, you know, that I'm thoroughly bashing metamodernism, I'm certainly not trying to do that. I think actually, like you said, that these theories, even if they are to some degree not the whole picture, they are a useful platform from which to jump into this quite different world of people like Gebser or even Rob Berbea, who I've had on the show. That's just a different kind of thing that I find very challenging to even talk about, but I find so enlivening in my own life.
Yeah. I feel that this... the difficulty in trying to articulate anything beyond the mental is so momentous. You know, this is something that the mental has been, in the perspective, have been coalescing for thousands and thousands of years, and there being that structure of consciousness is being undone in a very quick way, you know. So I don't know, I guess I have patience for where we're at, although unfortunately we do have to take a leap. And that's the kind of irony of the present moment, where there's a crisis. And I think the crisis is forcing us to very quickly kind of try things out. Some of it's going back and bringing up healthy forms of the mental, or the magical and the mythical, which is certainly happening and has happened in the 20th century. But I think we're getting to a point where we're really going to have to try to take this jump. And that's what I do like about the Gebserian approach, at least, is that it's not a singular approach exactly, but it's just saying that we need to take a leap, and that these transformations occur in leaps and not increments. There may be some incremental coalescing and crystallizing within a structure, but taking that leap into the new, that takes some courage to take that jump, you know. And experimentation and a willingness to fail. You know, I think we're gonna make mistakes, you know, and nobody, you know, not even Gebser was doing, you know, things completely right. I mean, he makes some assumptions as well, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I remember I had this conversation, I got a lot of feedback on it with Jordan Greenhall and Bonita Roy, where we kind of tried to play in an emergent kind of space of not knowing, which felt very different than, you know, a standard podcast conversation. Mm-hmm. It felt much more liminal, as Jordan might say. And it was very vulnerable because I realized that the mind I have, and you know, I've seen this in various ways, but that the mind I have is so conditioned, perhaps in this case we might say, by the perspectival, that when you venture forth into some different territory, it activates so many of your defense mechanisms. Like, it makes it really hard to speak. For me, I've just found like it was really hard to trust what I was saying in that conversation, or to know if what I was saying was coming from a integral kind of place, if that makes sense. And it does feel like exploring or manufacturing a new mind. Like, and that's something that Bonita says, mm-hmm. that we have to build a new mind for this world that we're heading into. And I wonder if you have any guidance or sense of how we might explore this new mind, like from a Gebserian perspective, how could we take this into our life and start to play with the aperspectival, play with developing these new structures of consciousness?
Hmm. That's a great question. Because as we were talking about a little earlier, I think before the recording, is, you know, one of the questions you were asking was if Gebser had any kind of contemplative or meditative practices or recommendations. And I think this is actually a good time to bring that up, in the sense, first of all, he didn't really. He was quite a, you know, early 20th century European who probably didn't have access to mm-hmm. to these things. And yet, throughout his writing, throughout his work, is this constant recommendation of supra wakeful presence in bringing that into everything that you're doing and everything you're investigating, especially if you are trying to reacclimate yourself to the so-called past, the psychistic world, the imagistic world, the world that we described as, you know, as the unconscious in psychology, and the kind of emotional psychological world. You have to bring a super wakeful presence to that, and also to the future, and really to anything, and to yourself. And in an interesting way, he has this a few lines in the first part of the Ever-Present Origin that I found to be very similar to what Jung said about taking back the opposites or taking back the projections. And it's this idea that, you know, what you shout in the what you hear in the forest, what you shout is what comes back to you. And so we should always be very aware of what we're bringing out into the world, what we're speaking forth into the world, and what we're hearing back is an echo of ourselves. So there's a kind of a contemplative orientation that I think Gebser offers us in terms of grounding ourselves in these structures of consciousness, but not to even say it that way. It sounds so abstract. I mean, to ground yourself into the beingness of who you are, of past, present, and future, the childhood you, the you that's made up of generations of people who've lived through these different worlds, the you that, you know, is the father of, you know, unborn children of the far future. Somehow we can be present in that. And that super wakeful presence isn't privileging the waking mind, but a kind of a lucidity. And Gebser describes integral consciousness as a sort of intensification of lucidity that's able to, his synonymous term is diaphaneity, mm-hmm. or diaphany. Mm-hmm. And it's this idea of the darkness and the light, the waking mind and the dreaming mind, all of these different structures of being and being in the world are all present to this diaphanous, transparent wholeness. There's a kind of a presence throughout all of that. And for Gebser, you know, really talking about the integral structure isn't necessarily a conceptual thing. It's there's a super wakeful presence that's been here through it all, that sort of envelops all of time and becoming, everything that has happened and will happen, and it's in us, and it's just this amazing clarity. This is amazing spiritual diaphaneity, and it's present in us. And the more we can orient ourselves to that and not project onto other people our issues and our problems, and or divide ourselves, you know, that kind of intensification of consciousness is exactly what we need to orient ourselves in and begin to inhabit. And, you know, I don't want to reify what I've been saying, but the last thing I would probably recommend, you know, Gebser says one of the prerequisites for in doing that is this new sense of time in which these other structures of consciousness that the perspectival has disowned are taken, they're retracted, they're brought back into our presence. And the future is brought back into our presence. So it comes down to presence, but it also kind of comes to this integrum as an activity of presencing the past, present, and future. Does that make sense, or does that just sound
absurd? No. It lands. I mean, the whole time thing I find very challenging to grok. Like, I can mm-hmm. kind of play towards it in my practice, like as a kind of imaginal mm-hmm. exercise, what it would be like for the future to be present now, and sort of get a feel for it. And I wonder if you could share, like, how do you experience that? If sort of you know, past, present, and future taken in the present, how does that show up in your life, or what does that feel like?
So Deleuze and Bergson are helpful for me here. And I'd have to start with the presence of the past before I can talk about the future, simply because there is more of a tangible sense of the past, and of course, in our memory, in our experience, that we can immediately plug into. I think it's sort of allowing that memory to not be framed as a memory, but to just be present and to allow it to speak to us, and to allow, you know, ourself from when we were 10 years old, you know, there was a phenomenological way we were being in the world, and we can access that, you know, we can be present there, and it's not a rational thing. I think as a practice, it's not really a rational thing. Bergson, who I was mentioning, he has this idea that, you know, the past is this living intensity that we can come in contact with. And anytime we remember something, we're interacting with it. It's not just a kind of a tape that we're just playing over that has no qualia or intensity to it. It's actually kind of the presence of the past. And Deleuze has the same concept that to remember something is to bring it to life again, is to make the past again. So I think it's this idea that we're always in contact with the past as a presence, and we can come into contact with that personally, in many different ways. One is sort of, you know, memory and reflection and that sort of thing. It's also ancestry. You know, there are these kind of invisible threads and traces, I think, that a lot of people who have contemplative practice or in some form of spiritual tradition have felt, you know, these kinds of, I don't want to say parapsychological moments, but sometimes sometimes it's remembering things that, you know, we're not quite sure what to do with that in the sort of the rational mind. But it's just sort of allowing those things to be. And in the same way, when we're imagining the future has a felt tangible latency. If you are an artist and you're creating something, you are encountering the future. You're encountering something that's present with you right now that you want to bring into being out of latency. And so I think for me, the future is a little harder to wrap our heads around. You know, it's kind of a science fiction concept almost, but understanding it is a sort of creative process in which something is latent in us and wishes to be brought out and realized. That's the future in terms of a phenomenological, tangible sense, right? Yeah. Otherwise, you know, we could go into movies and, like, for me, Arrival, the science fiction film Arrival, is this sort of great mythologizing of this integral consciousness that Gebser was talking about, because that's sort of one of the, I don't know have you seen that film?
Arrival, I think I have. That's the one where they have to translate the language. Is that right? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. there's a, I don't know if we should spoil it, but there's a very important temporal factor in that film about what the protagonist has to realize about the nature of time and reality. And it's sort of this gift that's given to humanity. But I think that's a great sort of mythologizing of this process to lean into the future, into the latency of the future. You know, Le Guin has this line, Ursula K. Le Guin. I think she very much is sort of playing with this idea of in a creative form, right? She has a great book called Always Coming Home. And in it, she has an opening essay just about the archaeology of the future. And I think, again, creative types and artists get this, that many times when you're telling a story and you're working on something creative, it has a kind of autonomy of itself, and you're really interacting with it and entering into it. You're an explorer of a world, and you're just trying to write down what you see and what unfolds. But what happens if you're trying to write down the future? There's this interesting play. So she has this question, you know, which are farther out from us, right? Farther away from contact with us, the dead or the unborn? And it's this sort of sense of the boundaries that were previously felt to be certain. And Gebser talks about this, especially in some of his poetry, about the invisible and the visible worlds, right? The boundaries between those two, between the dead and the unborn, those are the kind of boundaries that diaphaneity, as a spiritual potency, as a structure of consciousness, might allow us to see through. And yeah, that sounds a little mystical, but you know, this is where Gebser was going with it. This is where Sri Aurobindo was going with his talking about, you know, the supramental. So I would just kind of say, like, it's okay to kind of go there as well in terms of what this means in terms of inhabiting time, as Gebser describes as time freedom, which is time wholeness. And he has another word, the achronon, right? Which is a fancy way of saying time freedom. There's a spiritual dimension to this that I think is really important. But this doesn't mean that we're all going to become these contemplatives that can see into the past and to the future or something. I think in a real tangible material way, in a perspectival way that translates to our terminology, this is just sort of the world that we're entering into in a kind of phenomenological sense. Transparency is such a hot subject right now, you know, immanence and networks and relationship and interbeing with the ecological world, you know, the boundaries between civilization and the rest of nature are melting down, you know? So there's a lot of boundary thinning that's going on right now. And whether you prescribe this profound contemplative mystical understanding of, you know, superseding the boundaries of the living and the dead, et cetera, it's almost, you don't need to go there quite yet. You're actually already feeling it with everything that's happening right now in the Anthropocene.